Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. I'm Josh Schimmels, publisher and CEO of the Los Angeles Business Journal.
And I'm Todd Wilson, regional president for Greater Los Angeles for PNC Bank.
Every episode, we sit down with leaders who've built, scaled, and reimagined companies that shape the way Los Angeles and the world does business.
Today's conversation is with an entrepreneur who turned a garage-born idea into a global technology brand that has become synonymous with home security. Ring, now part of Amazon, with millions of devices protecting neighbors and neighborhoods around the world.
It began as a single prototype called DoorBot. And today, under Jamie Siminoff's leadership, Ring has grown into a leader in smart home security. It's a name we all know and recognize. It's integrating AI, smart cameras, and neighborhood safety tool. And I think it's doing it all in a way that maintains its original mission, which is as simple as making neighborhoods safer.
And along the way became a story about innovation, perseverance, and the intersection of technology, privacy, and consumer trust.
Today's guest has seen it all. He's led that journey from startup founder to Amazon vice president, shaping the future of connected devices. Jamie Siminoff, welcome to C-Speak.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Let's go back in time. Ring started as a simple idea in your garage. It quickly became a company with global impact. Everybody knows the name. Looking back at the early days, what drove you to take the leap from what was a small prototype to pursuing a much bigger vision for the business? How did you just know the potential that it had?
Well, I didn't know. I had been sort of a serial entrepreneur, which means someone who has not found something successful. I just kind of kept going from like one thing to the next. I was inventing things, but nothing really was sticking. I was in the garage and I couldn't hear the doorbell and just got an iPhone. iPhone was new then. And I looked online for a Wi-Fi doorbell that none existed. So I just kind of hacked one up for my own needs.
And for our listeners, what time frame was this?
This is 2011.
Okay.
Like, go back to 2011. It's like, it doesn't sound like it's that long ago, but the challenges were like, is there enough internet to have a video camera? Like Wi-Fi, like all these things, like was Wi-Fi everywhere? And so it was, the timing was perfect. Look at it from a business side. That's exactly when you want to come out, which is like when things are starting to form before they formed fully. If I had come out with it 3 years earlier, there wouldn't have been enough iPhones in the market to see the camera. You needed the other side. And so it's kind of amazing when you go back that like the timing was literally just perfect.
Yeah, I think my very first Ring was hardwired. It was hardwired through the wall.
Yep.
And that's changed quite a bit.
When we have battery, hardwired, power over Ethernet. I mean, I honestly don't even know how many SKUs we have now. I mean, it's probably over 100.
So back in the early days, when the product and the company were known as DoorBot,
yep,
instead of Ring, talk about how that product evolved and the obstacles that you came with really scaling it to be a workable product.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first good lesson is just, it was called DoorBot, which was a terrible name. But, you know, it's like, I was like a guy in a garage and I made a door robot. And so you sort of put it out and then you realize this is where like you get customer feedback and people are saying, I bought the DoorBot, but my spouse won't let me put it on the front door because they say like, we're not putting a DoorBot on the front door. And it's like, ooh, that was a bad name. And so we changed the name. But yeah, going back then, I mean, it was kind of like stumbling into the aha moment. It wasn't a, like you invented it and like light bulb goes off, you run out of the garage, you start screaming. It's like, I needed a doorbell. The doorbell didn't work to my phone. I was in the garage. I couldn't hear it. So I started like, I looked for something. It didn't exist. So I hacked one up. I put it on the front door. The most aha thing was my wife said that she felt like it made us safer at home. And that was like the first, I'd say like the nibbles or like nuggets of like, this might be something more than just fixing an itch that I have in my garage.
So let's come back to the product for a second. How did you as an inventor in your garage turn into a company?
I've always said like the company is the thing I didn't want, but needed to have. I'd love to just invent things, but the company was a kind of the thing I needed to have in order to sort of to make my invention actually become
probably
reality.
To provide more capital to help you do it as well, right?
It's just like, it's funny. I'm almost sure if I'd gone to anyone at that time, we kind of did. Like we went to other security companies and talked to them and like no one saw it. No one's like, oh, I'll just license this from you and take it. We'll build Ring. Looking back, they certainly wish they had. But I think it takes the founder. This is where like founders and entrepreneurs, like that's where we're so valuable is it's, the idea is like a piece of that, but it's really like that passion to take the thing from A to B.
Well, that's really interesting because you were really working on creating a product, not necessarily creating a company. The company helped launch the product and helped propel it to everybody's homes. Let's stay on the concept of being a serial entrepreneur. I think you described it as, it just means you had a bunch of failed inventions prior to that.
It's like a frustrated person in a garage, but yeah.
Okay. So today, you're a leader within one of the largest companies in the entire world. Talk about the idea of what it's like to have that entrepreneurial mind and spirit inside a company the size of Amazon. How do those coexist?
So I'm very lucky that I'm at Amazon, which I'd say is still somewhat founder led. I mean, Jeff is still definitely somewhat involved. Andy is basically like a founder. There's lots of people there in the sort of executive suite and even across Amazon that have been there for a real long time. They are very founder, entrepreneur, inventor friendly. And so it's not that hard to be there doing it. And I think I do look at invention. It's funny because some people say like inventing, it's like they look at like you invented a doorbell. But if you look at the things that have been most impactful, it's inventing a new way to promote people. Inventing, like, invention is not just a product. Invention is every single thing. It's like how you do every process and reinventing it. And so at Amazon, what's fun is at the scale we're at, like anything you touch is massive. You know, if you reinvented a process around promoting people and that does anything, if it moves anything, a tiny, tiny little bit, 1%, a half a percent, a millionth of a percent, it's still actually super impactful. So it's fun to be at a place where you can like, you know, and to have a voice where you can get heard and do this. So it's been, for me, it's been kind of a fun place to run around and invent.
So one of the things I know that you're known for is having a connection to the customers and a strong customer feedback loop. Talk about how that helped you kind of evolve the product and ultimately ring the company.
Yeah. And I'd say like another lucky break that became, you know, it's like, it's sort of like this accidental thing that became sort of like really impactful is I put my email in every box. I did it originally because like we didn't have customer service. I mean, it wasn't like, this wasn't like, it's not sophisticated. Like we're sending out doorbots. We don't have customer service. I put my email in the box. Like it's just
your
like,
personal email.
When you say personal work, it's like, it was me. Like I was sending out the product. Like, I mean, there was like, who else was around to put their email on? Like I had to like, someone had to get the emails. And so like the first ones, and then it just kind of like became like, we're shipping another product, like put the email on it. And then it just kind of became a thing. And we now obviously have customer service, but we have over 100 million devices in the field.
Wow.
And my email is out there. It's on every box. We call our customers neighbors. Like our neighbors are actually like, we're all like pretty respectful. So I get really good emails, whether it's like, and I mean good, like a good email to me is like, you want to find problems. Like you want to make your business better. So the fact that like I get an email that we caused an issue is good because now I can dig in. Now we can root cause it. And so what I found is that people do use me as that safety net. It's like the last thing in their frustration of something. So that's on the, I'll call it the negative side, but where we can fix things and make them better. It also keeps it that everybody in the company knows that the customer's number one. When I'm willing to answer every single email from any customer, it means that everyone in the company is willing to answer every single email from every customer. They're also, they understand there's no one's above the customer. And I think the customer is number one. And that's a thing Jeff has had with Amazon. And he's like, it's funny, the only other CEO or of any large organization I know who has had their email out there is jeff@amazon.com. And so Jeff was always very available for his customers, especially like in the e-commerce side and everything else. And you get this ground truth of data. You know, I really hate surveys because I think that they water down all the information. And I do think as someone who's leading a business, who's inventing new products, who's trying to invent the future, you want ground truth data. You want to get the understanding of what's actually happening and hear it directly from people.
Are there instances where customers have led to product innovation, expansion?
Tons. I mean, like I'd say like if people had said to, you know, Henry Ford, build a faster thing, he would have built like, it was a faster horse. Like it's not that they're telling me like build a car. It's not like they said, no, here's a car, go build it. I'm like, oh my God, I should build a car. It's they're saying like, you know, my car's being broken into in front of my house. And it's like, I need to see in front of my house more. Oh, wow. And it's like, oh, there's a floodlight above every single car, a motion detection floodlight. Like, what happens if we make a floodlight camera? So it's like these things, like it's getting that ground truth of data. So you're understanding what's truly happening out there allows you to then build things that no one's ever seen before. And I'd say like the floodlight camera is a product that just didn't exist. And now it's, you know, it's on like millions of homes. It's kind of like the default floodlight is a camera.
Well, at this point, most of us have gone back and we watched the episode Shark Tank and we saw your pitch. It's considered today the biggest miss of all time. yep. or the sharks.
That is,
didn't get this one right.
That was very true.
Okay. So you've gone from being, and I hate to use the word, but kind of rejected on the show, right? You were rejected on the show, and then you were brought in years later as a guest judge. What a full circle moment that must have been. Talk to us a little bit about that moment and going from pitching to being one of the mentors.
Yeah. So, I mean, going on Shark Tank for me was, I would say, the same as someone in the Olympics, like an amateur athlete that trains all their life to be a javelin thrower or whatever. And like now they have their Olympic moment, like they're going to go to the Olympics and it's like, wow, like they're going to Los Angeles 2028, like, holy cow. And you have this like one thing that you do and you get judged on it. And it's like, you either win or you lose. So going on Shark Tank, I mean, I built the set and I had friends come over and they asked me questions and I trained as if it was the Olympics to go on. So I took it very seriously. I thought that was the pinnacle of my sort of inventing career, was getting on Shark Tank. I will say it's probably like my one unhumble brag, because I'd like to think of myself as still like a humble person who has my email out there and like still is inventing and building and working. But I mean, we are by far the largest company ever to appear on the show. So it's cool to be like, to go to the Olympics and sort of like be the Michael Phelps of the Olympics is kind of cool. Cause I think that's like, you know, if that's the analogy, I think that's probably we're in that line of something like that. And then going back on the show as a shark was insane.
And did you make any investments?
I did. I made an investment in a, this woman that's in La Belle, Missouri, and she has a meat, direct to consumer meat business called Moink. We do ethically farmed meats and like, I was sort of a, like a box of meat that you get shipped to your house. The business has actually done really well. I ended up buying a farm out in La Belle, Missouri. I rebuilt the town in La Belle, Missouri, and we're
you pronounce Missouri correctly?
I pronounce. So, and what's funny is it's Missouri. And like, if you go to Kansas City, like they're the city folk, it's Missouri. But for us in the Northeast,
for us
farmers in the Northeast, it's Missouri. And so it's become like a place. I mean, it's been almost 8 years that I've been there now. I love going there. And so this is my problem. It's like, this is why I say like, you know, I think there's different, I think entrepreneur is like a big term. I think there's different types of entrepreneurs. Like I think I'm more of an entrepreneur, the one that we typically think of is more of a business person,
right?
And they're intelligent. I'm more of an inventor. I like to build stuff. I like to fix stuff. And so like I go to La Belle, Missouri, and I see that the town is like kind of had some issues with, you know, there's been some opioids that have gone through those areas and there's like industrial farming and it was a beautiful town, but now it's like kind of 700 people. And I'm like, we can fix this. And so we fix the sidewalks, we fix the streets, we put a coffee shop. And like now it's like actually a really nice town people live in. And I love going there, but that's who I am as like an inventor. It doesn't matter that people are like, what's the output of that? Or what's the outcome? Or what's that? I'm like, I don't know, like a better town for people. It's like, but I see something is broken. I want to fix it. I saw my doorbell. I couldn't hear my garage. I wanted to fix it. I see crime in neighborhoods. And that became the thing with Ring. How do we make neighborhoods safer? And so like, that's, which is why Ring has been such a fun one to stay on for so long, because crime is like something you almost can never solve. I think with AI, we might get closer than I ever thought, but it's one you can never solve.
Jamie, I want to go back to a moment. Yeah. You and I have known each other for a long time, and I may not be getting this exactly correct, but never, yeah, that's okay. Well, I was with you, I think, right after the Shark Tank episode had aired.
Yep.
We were over at Andy's house doing a big Argentinian barbecue, and you were looking at your phone, and I remember seeing you how, or just talk about that minute from when the Shark Tank was airing for the first time with Doorbot on the East Coast, about how it really changed your life forever.
So again, to go to the Olympics, you go there and you like throw your javelin or whatever it is and you do your thing and then you don't win a medal. Like
no one knew you didn't win a medal yet, even at that point, right? Until it airs.
And it's like, you know, it's like, I felt like I was someone who like appeared in the Olympics, but didn't get the medal. Cause like the medal is like, get a deal with the shark. But I needed money too. It was not a game for me. Like, I needed money. I was there to raise money. Mark Cuban, I was sure was going to give me money. He did not give me money. I was sure he was. And so we get on there and like, oh, wow, this is bad. We didn't get a deal, but okay, we were at least on the show. Hopefully that'll get some sales from being on it. So it airs. And like the sales were like good, but not like, they were okay. The first day, like 24 hours, they were like medium. Like it was like better than like a normal day, but you're also expecting that, like, I mean, right. I don't know, like how long, why would it sell for longer than like a few hours? Like you're on the show and it's just like, but then like day two, the sales were the same as day one. You're like, well, that's good.
Yeah.
And so I think I saw you like day three. And it's like, day three, it's like, sales are still the same. Like, this is really good now. Like, you know, it's like, because it's like the additive. And then it's like, day four was the same as day one, two, and three. And then it, like, day five was bigger than one, two, three, four. And you're like, what is going on? And so it became, we ended up
a new bar set.
It was a new bar set. It went like, I mean, it was crazy. We just had our product coming in at the time. Huh. We had not sold enough of it. I was definitely going out of business. And it is like, you know, luck has to be your co-pilot a little bit. We were lucky on timing. We were lucky to get on Shark Tank. We were lucky when Shark Tank aired. And we were lucky that when it aired, we had product coming in and Shark Tank let us sort of, and it gave this little boost of energy. It was like drinking like a Red Bull. You know, it just gave you this like burst of energy that gave us this little burst to get us a little bit above, like, you know, just to kind of break out of the clouds. And then we could then use that momentum to sort of get to Ring. So I really do, I'd say, like, I think it's thousands of things that made Ring into what it is today. I would say that probably the one that maybe was the most important was getting on Shark Tank.
So that appearance, regardless of the investment, it was huge.
It ended up being, I mean, at that time, you know, Shark Tank's still a very big show, but it was a massive
must
show.
Must watch TV.
It was like must watch TV Friday night. Yeah. Everyone watched it. I would say it's probably the same as having a Super Bowl ad. I think for a company like ours, it might be better than a Super Bowl ad at that point because you got to explain it and talk to it and have someone understand who you were.
Jamie, I know that you love Ring. This is your baby. As it post Shark Tank grew and grew and grew, how did you maintain the culture? How did you ensure that it was the company you wanted it to be?
So I think, first of all, culture, I think, should be unique. Like, culture should be something that doesn't work for everyone. If it works for everyone, it's probably not a culture. For me, it was like the mission allowed us a really North Star around something. And then we had some other customer and sort of keeping that email on the box. And so there was things that like I did that were, especially early on, and then it started to grow really fast. It's very hard to keep a culture when you grow fast because you're just bringing new people in. And so some of those things were so strong that they did keep a culture. It is like people and culture. That's what builds companies, makes companies, what makes them special. Like that's like, it's everything. And so it was, I think we were like, again, kind of lucky, but it was really that like mission to make neighborhoods safer. And when you got people that you'd say to them, like, if you don't believe in that, you know, it's kind of don't be here. And I meant it like in a nice, not in like a mean way, but like a nice way. Like if you don't believe that's what you want to do, like if you don't wake up in the morning, you're excited to make neighborhoods safer. Honestly, like go do something else. Like it's totally fine. It's just, you're not for us. And that just kept that sort of like mission going. But I always say, like, if we've just focused on making neighborhoods safer, we'll always be rewarded by the customer, by our neighbor. And so I think it ended up being a really good way to do it. Instead of saying like, we're going to sell $100 million of product. When you start to become tactical like that, very hard to have a culture in your company when you're tactical. Yeah. If all you're setting is a goal, like we're going to sell 1 million units, we're going to do this, we're going to be the biggest this. That's not really like that, you know, people start looking at ways to cut corners, to do things, to like become more profitable. And at some point, businesses do become big and you have to do some stuff. But I think especially when we were young, focusing on that and the idea that we get rewarded by doing the right thing. I mean, it like, so we ended up growing 1,000 times faster than anyone could have projected. I mean, it was literally, we grew so fast. Mm. It was funny going through the book and seeing like really kind of like unpacking the story again, like, and seeing it now from like years past. So like being able to like really, we grew so fast, we had to sell the company because like we were running out of money.
Right.
Growth is good to a point. I mean, you know, you're a bank and we appreciate banks to be there, but like at some point, you know, banks can't loan you when you're doing 30 million in sales. You go to the bank and say, I need 200 million to buy product for next year. They're like, Jamie, you're doing 30 million in sales. Like, yeah, I know. We're going to do 200 million next year. And they're like, maybe. It doesn't happen. And then when we did, we went from, you know, 3 million to 30 million. That was actually like kind of, you could do it because it was like small enough that like you could get money from people. 30 million to 170, much tougher. Then we did 170 to 480. So again, now we just went to 170. Go meet with the bank and say, okay, now I need like 300 million to buy product for next year. And you're like, but you only need 170 million in revenue. And by the way, you're losing a ton of money right now. And you're like, I know, but I need some money.
Yeah.
And so it just, you know, product.
So how did you solve that problem?
It raised a lot of money, loaned a lot of money. I mean, like hook and crook, you know, try to do vendor financing. I mean, like literally like every single stone was turned over, but we still kept running out of money. And the other thing is, the person running your customer service at 30 million, that the business at 170, that's a totally different business than 30. Some people can make it, some people can't. And so like, I mean, if you think about it, like the person you'd hire to run $170 million a year business, you know, X, sort of the vertical of X, is very different than 30, is different than 480. Those things happened within 24 months. So like you're just talking about, it's like a snake shedding its skin. Like we were like a different animal every few months. And some people could grow and adapt, and some people just could not make the leap.
Well, so let's talk about that from a business perspective. You've described yourself a few times today as an inventor.
Yep.
So I presume you're constantly looking for new products and new opportunities. How do you do that while also making sure that these new products and these new ideas and these inventions align with the long-term strategy for the company? Because it is now a company.
And that's the mission. It's so great. When you have a clear mission, you just keep asking yourself, why are we doing this? And that's, I'd say that, I mean, the things you say no to as you're growing as a business, like those are the most important things. Like if you look at any company that's large and that grew, it's how they focused when they grew. It's not that they did 1,000 things. Like even Apple, it was like there was a few products that sort of created Apple. It wasn't 1,000 products. And so it was like, and I mean, I guess probably Steve was the best at all saying no to like the buttons and all like just simplifying. And simplifying mm-hmm. is actually the toughest thing. So the mission allowed us to, when someone came to us and said, you know, the smart lighting is growing. We're a smart home company. It's like, we're not a smart home company. We're making neighborhood safer company. Does that make a neighborhood safer? Now, by the way, if it did, okay, great. And sometimes you could bend it a little bit. And if it was a very low swing, you could set it go into it. But if it was in a core product line, something that we were really working on that like was going to take a lot of resources, that had to really reduce crime in neighborhoods. Floodlight camera, like, okay, well, the lights, well, yeah, but the lights show that there's presence. Okay, we love that. Like, we love where it's mounted. Oh, this is a making neighborhood safer product. We're going to go all in on this.
Well, that's so interesting. You talk about Apple and Ring, and sometimes simple is better. It reminds me of my 17-year-old daughter works at In-N-Out, and talk about a simple concept, another Southern California company that's ultra successful. Yep. And it's about simplicity. Their menu is simple. Everything is simple. Sometimes simple rules.
I mean, there's a line out the door of every In-N-Out everywhere. And why? Because they can deliver quality food at scale, but they do it because it is the same thing over and over again. Like they've just simplified it. And of course they know they could add a million other products and a million other things and fried chicken and all this stuff, but that would ruin the whole thing. And so they've had this, I don't even know how much In-N-Out's worth. It's a private company. It's probably one of the larger ones in the country. Yeah. At this point. And it's funny because they're one of the largest, most successful restaurants by doing like really like two things, I'd say.
Exactly.
Like a burger and fries. I mean, I don't think there's
the shake.
I mean, it's like, but like, you know, but it's, they're not like anyone else could do the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's like Southwest, which was one of the most successful airlines. What did they do? One type of plane, like the seating, all the stuff. Now, again, companies grow, they change and whatever. And we've actually seen that with Southwest, the more that they started to make it complex and they bought other companies and did this, then all of a sudden their systems went down. So that's when it gets too complex.
Often we see that throughout a company's life cycle, you know, someone is a good inventor, someone is good at launching a company, someone's good at running a company. You know, there aren't very many Jeff Bezos or you for that matter. Now, what made you, you know, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, whomever it is, what made you capable of going from inventor to CEO of a $1 billion+ company?
I think that I actually call myself the chief inventor at Ring. So I am the CEO, but I actually don't call, I call myself the chief inventor. I think it is by celebrating and being sort of very comfortable with what I am and who I am. What it does is it allows people around me to take up, like, I'm not a good operator. Like,
so part of knowing who you are is knowing who you're not as well.
Yeah.
Right?
So yeah. And by knowing who you're not, if I set up the CEO, people aren't going to step into things that even if I'm doing it poorly, because they don't want to step on my toes.
Okay.
And so I think a lot of times what happens is someone like the founder wants to run the business and they sort of like, they're going to be like, they're going to keep like the control and keep it hard. And I think then you don't allow the things you're not good at for people to take the slack. And that's the thing. A lot of the stuff, like people will naturally find their way into the cracks and fix them if you let them. I think the problem is a lot of companies is we're so rigid. Like we didn't have we really didn't have titles to start. I always said like we had like 40 CEOs, like everyone was kind of a CEO. Now they knew their area. Like if you ran customer service, you knew that you weren't going to China to build a product. But if you were the CEO of customer service, you also understood if something's wrong in your business, you have to fix it. And if that could be anything within your business, you're just going to do it as a CEO does or as a founder or business owner does. And so I do think like that was part of the magic. And I'd say if you look at Amazon, it's actually for a very long time, any big company at some point, you have to have more structure. But I'd say overall, it's actually still a lot like that for a big company.
So Jamie, when did you sell the company to Amazon?
So New Year's Eve of 2017, I signed the agreement and we closed early 2018.
So since that time in the last 7 years, I know you were at Amazon early, but it wasn't a straight line to where you are today.
Nothing's a straight line.
Exactly.
Nothing.
So you left Amazon, you did a couple of different ventures, but then you came back.
Yes.
So why'd you leave? Why'd you come back? And what's the future of Ring now with you back at the helm?
So I grew it from really, I mean, from my garage to, we sold it. We were doing about 500, a little bit less than 500 million in 2017 when I sold it. I almost more than 10x'd it while I was at Amazon. So it was an insane run. It was just flat out, you know, pedal to the metal, like pinned the entire time. At some point, I think I just realized that I was just burnt out.
Okay.
I felt like I wasn't the best person leading it anymore. I didn't have the vision anymore. I just kind of felt that. I felt it was in a good place. It was profitable. So I felt like I had delivered a great thing for Jeff and the team at Amazon. So I stepped back, and then to my Olympics metaphor, it's like I was a javelin thrower and I went and started swimming and I realized I hate swimming. Like I'm a javelin thrower. It's like, I got one thing. Like I throw the javelin, like, and I'm really good at it. So I'm like, why? And so I kind of went back to Amazon and said, listen, I should have stayed. I love this thing. I love doing it. I love inventing. I love building stuff. With AI also.
Okay.
It completely opens us up. I mean, we're literally back to, I mean, we always say it at Amazon day one, but it really like, it's really like we're back to day one. Like everything I'm doing now is like starting fresh again, but I'm starting fresh with I'm now in the world's largest garage building this.
With the world's largest wallet.
Jensen has the world's largest wallet. I'm like his stepbrother or something, but yeah, but we have a good wallet. And so I have this like unbelievable thing that I can use as garage that has at scale to now take AI and really impact this mission that we had. So it's fun to come back and it's fun to just kind of be back in it.
So what does innovation look like for the next 5 to 10 years?
I'd say, I mean, innovation for us is what, like with AI, you know, our mission to make neighborhoods safer, like how, like what can you now do with that? Because previous to AI, you could do stuff around this, but like, you know, think about how much camera footage was just being thrown away because no one kind of could look at it. I mean, you just can't afford to look at it, right? The richest people in the world, the most secure places, they do all these studies that if a security guard watches a camera for too long, like it's after like 5 minutes, their ability to see things in that camera go down by like 50%.
Okay.
Because you're humans. Like it's just like just reality. AI allows us to get all this rich data to look at it, to see it. So from we're doing smart event alerts now. So it tells me like, there's a person mowing your lawn versus now having to be motion detection. So now I'm already like, again, this is a step, right? It's like a step in the right direction. But you can kind of think of how that goes. We're also doing that. We're launching live very shortly. We've already announced it is a thing called Search Party. So we get over 1 million pets a year entered into our neighbor's app that are lost, missing, found, whatever. So now if your dog is missing in your neighborhood, you load it up and you're like, my dog's Biscuit. So like, I'll say like, so Biscuit's lost. Here's a picture of Biscuit. And now all of a sudden someone down the street will get an alert on their camera that says, hey, Todd, this dog in front of your house looks like this dog that's missing.
Now, Biscuit may be in your front yard.
Now here's what's so cool. From a privacy side, if you say like, no, or like you can just basically like exit out, no one knows. All your data is kept private. No one knows that you ever saw it, whatever. If you're a good person, which I hope you are, you're gonna be like, yes, contact neighbor. Yes, Jamie, this Biscuit just ran by my house, or I was able to get it and it's in my lawn right now. Come over and get it. And so it's like, what an amazing way to use these networks of cameras. And so with AI, I think we can do this. And I do think, and this is where AI is, I think, making people very nervous, as I can understand it. I mean, it's a very powerful thing, but I do think we can do it in a way that's very privacy protected, where you have 100% control, but that you get the benefits, like with Search Party, you get the benefits of the community without this kind of idea of surveillance. And so your control is 100%.
Well, I think that leads into, you know, asking, so, you know, as you're looking at building this new technology, you've got AI, you've got all these tools, you've got experience at your back. How do you build and use this new technology in a way that's smart and it's helpful? And you use the example of somebody getting the alert and, you know, anonymously is saying, no, that doesn't look like the dog. Yeah. But how do you do that in a responsible way? What efforts are being taken?
I think you always start with, I always say like privacy, trust is our number one thing. And people was like, oh, it's kind of like, that's your talking point. It's like, thanks for the talking point. Like, you know, it's like, cause a lot of people are, oh, privacy, like we care. The reality is that when I say we get rewarded, like we get rewarded when someone puts a Ring on their house, they're not going to reward us if they don't trust us. And they're not going to trust us if we violate that. And so we do have to protect them. We do have to give them control, everyone. And we have to make sure that's what we do while also still accomplishing the mission of making them safer, because they bought our product to try to make themselves or neighborhood safer. So it is a balance there, but the balance is that trust has to be number one. And I do think we can, as inventors, we can invent things. We have this community alerts, which local police can request, like if there's a burglary in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. they'll be like, you know, on Friday night, could you give us footage? You know, here's the burglary. Here's this incident from Thursday to Saturday. We'd love to have some footage to be able to look in your thing if you could help us with this burglary. If you say no, they don't even know they asked you. So it's, they're just putting the request out there. We take the request. We give it, we send it out to all of our neighbors. If you say no, no one even knows. Like they don't know that they requested it from you. If you say yes, then obviously then they get the footage and then you can help them. And so I think that's a way that the community can work with police, but again, do it in a way that if for some reason during that time you feel like you didn't want to share or you don't want to share or whatever, that's totally fine. And you should have that level of control.
So it's an opportunity, not an obligation.
Yes.
So Jamie, obviously imitation is the greatest form of flattery here. And a number of other competitors or lookalikes have popped up. I guess, how do you view this market today and how do you differentiate Ring from the competitors?
What's funny is in every moment of time, like in real time, you always say like there's competitors. There have always been competitors to Ring since the day we launched until today. And, you know, so far we've just, again, by never focusing on the competitor, you know, we've been able to build new products, invent new things, deliver delight to our customers, build search party, do all these things, do all this stuff that's just completely different. And because of that, I think there is only one Ring. Like there's just no, like, I don't think there's any, call it competition. I think we are the only one in the neighborhood to buy that. I'm also obviously very biased on that, as you can imagine.
Obviously the value grows with scale.
Yeah.
Where are you guys relative to competitors in terms of your market share or your share?
You know, I assume based on driving around and seeing houses, I assume we're pretty big. But I really do focus on if we're in a meeting and someone talks about a competitor, I usually get upset because that, you know what that means? Like if you're driving, if I'm talking about telling you about a car, it's in front of me and blah, 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 and we're talking about it and I'm mad at it. Like it's in front of me. And so if it's behind me, it should be so far behind me, I can't see it. And I should be the one that's, I'm looking forward and trying to figure out how I'm going to navigate this, what I'm going to do, how I'm going to win. And so as soon as you start thinking about all this competition, you're no longer inventing the future. And to me, like, I mean, look at what Jensen's done with NVIDIA. Like he did not do that by thinking like, what's Intel doing? What's AMD doing? Like he did it by saying like, we're going to reduce the cycle time. We're going to build this special thing. We're going to like, and he is now in a market as large as what NVIDIA is doing, that there's literally not anyone that has a chip that's equal to his. It doesn't seem to be even close. I mean, there's other chips out there. There's definitely other AI chips, but it does seem like what the technology he has at the front is like literally in the car analogy, it's hard to see someone the next car in the rearview mirror. And there's stuff that's obviously coming up, but it's, I mean, you're talking about literally one of the biggest markets in the world right now. And it's like sort of, you have one, which is why it's a $5 trillion company. And so, you know, Ring, we didn't make it to 5 trillion.
Not yet.
Yeah. I mean, I got some time. But I think the way to do that is to, again, I think we get too focused on competition. I would say almost every company I've seen go out of business, lose their way, lose whatever, it's not because of competition. It's because they focused on competition. It's usually internal that you lose your way, that you lose yourself. It's not the external force. It's not the person launching this product that puts me out of business. It's my reaction to it internally that puts me out of business.
And talking about, you know, internally, you look at your team. So you're back, your chief inventor, and you described your team at one point had 40 CEOs and people acting as CEOs. How do you build your leadership team today that aligns with the new goals, the new missions of crazy expansion and crazy global growth, but sort of aligns with your values and your culture for where you see the next products going? How do you do that?
So I mean, one, we're very lucky that Amazon's, if you look at their leadership principles, they actually, like when I sold the business, I gave to our team kind of my scribbled, like what I said our culture was and kind of the leadership principles of Amazon. And I actually drew the lines. It's like, it almost like was like literally direct overlap. So one good thing is like in the business that we went into, there's direct overlap of culture of how we sort of thought about things. We still have a mission and that still drives us, which is great. I think we still have a founder's mentality. And again, Amazon has kind of led us. Overall, Amazon runs pretty founder mentality-ish, but I think they've also let us stay very founder mentality at Ring. And in some ways, I would say even bring that back into Amazon. I think, you know, Andy, if you look at a lot of his last letters that have come out, they're very founder mode. If you look at reading through what he's saying about bureaucracy and sort of leaning into AI and efficiencies and trying to, you know, really try to get there. And so it's been, you know, I think you can't buck. Like if we went to a place that didn't fit us, like you, to your question, it's more about that. It's like, if the system is against you, you're not going to be able to sort of do it. And so the fact that the system is kind of like worked for us, I think that's, and it's acquisitions. If you look, like the ones that work are the ones where they culturally overlap.
Right.
When the cultures aren't the same, I don't care how good the product is. I don't care how good the financial sort of like engineering is. And this is going to be plugged into this and this is going to work. Like the only thing that works is when the cultures, like the cultures merge, and then that creates like the success.
Jamie, what you talked about, a founder organization or founder-led organization, goes back a little bit. You know, you were the face of Ring, whether from the DoorBot days to the commercials to you and Ollie and Shaq, you know, and that sort of stuff. But I also noticed you're back to the face of Ring. And then in the latest round of commercials, it's you in front of a house with your Ring t-shirt. So I about this for a second.
Yeah, we actually ended up getting some good World Series ads in there. So that was kind of fun. So I got to be on the World Series, I guess. But, you know, if you go back to why I was the face of Ring, one of my mentor companies, I actually never met him, so I can't say he's my mentor. He is my mentor, he just doesn't know it, is James Dyson. Okay. And so James Dyson, when he built Dyson, it's like his ads used to be just like James Dyson was like, sit there and be like, I invented the vacuum by having 1,000 different things. He'd like be like, if you see Dyson on something, like, you know, it's better. And so to me, it was like, Ring has to be the Dyson of security. It has to be like when you go into Best Buy, there's going to be a million competitors. There has to be. If the industry grows and it's big, there's going to be competitors. There should be competition. But I want there only be one Dyson. I want there only one that you look at and you're like, I know that Ring means it's going to be the better product. If I see Ring on it, I trust that that's going to be the better product. So what do? You take the Dyson playbook. Well, part of the Dyson playbook is put yourself on it. Part of also why I put it on is like, I was the cheapest actor we had. And we owned me, you know, like that was the other side is like, if we used actors and you know, the problem is if you start to actually grow and you see this with some of them, like they become a celebrity of the company, but they're not the company. So like the Ring owned me, I owned Ring. It was great. And so like and it works. It's amazing. Like we test all the time, all these ads with and without me, and they work better with me. And again, it's not like me, it's the trust of a founder. Yeah. And I think people like, you know, again, in a world where things are going more digital and more whatever, like you want to buy things from a human. You want to understand there's a human behind it. You feel like that is trust.
I think in a weird way, it makes people relate to you. I think about your early pitch on Shark Tank, not getting the investment there, I think in a way makes more people relate to you because they understand the difficulties of business and trying and failing and getting up and keep going. So I think there's really something to that, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were a reject. People relate to the American dream and truly building it. And they watched it because they watched me on Shark Tank. It wasn't like an Ivy League thing that I got raised some great money and went out there and built this thing and like built a company. Like it was in my garage and it was on Shark Tank. I got rejected and it was embarrassing and you kind of worked your way back up.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, thank you for spending time with us today. I would like to say, I think I may be one of the few people who you actually hooked up my Ring I couldn't do it myself. You came over and hooked it up on my house. I don't know what year that might have been.
I mean, sadly, I would say not one of the few because I've hooked up a lot of Rings, but you definitely were one of the early ones I hooked up. Well, yes.
I appreciate what you've done today and being with us. I appreciate what you've done for inventors, for entrepreneurs. Most importantly, we appreciate what you and Ring have done in making neighborhoods safer. And that mission is one that we all can be supportive of. So thank you today for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been so great. Thanks for taking the time. You know, at the Business Journal, we really look for an opportunity to tell people's stories, success, business, community. Yours fits all of those molds. It checks all the boxes. It illustrates vision, persistence, execution. We've seen a global scale, now a name that's recognized everywhere. You're shaping an entire industry and you're doing it all while you're staying grounded to the values that are so important to you and that really help drive the mission from the get-go. Thank you for spending time with us today. On behalf of the Los Angeles Business Journal and PNC Bank, thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for future episodes and you can subscribe or follow. We look forward to hosting you on the next episode of PNCC Speak, the language of executives.